Cliffcentral.com.
I've got something important to tell you.
Cliffcentral.com.
Adrian Groenewald and Louis Groenewald here, and Alison Yandu. We are talking, and I think Richard Angus, we'll see which one of them are going to join us. They're joining the SMEs out there, but today is all about transformation issues, the next half hour anyway. And our special guest is Jules Newton. Welcome, Jules.
Thank you. Hi.
Good to meet you across the microphone. Mm. Before we go there, last week we had the editor of TFM magazine, Transformation magazine, and Stella Nolan. So there's a podcast for that. She shared her thoughts and feelings over several years building this magazine. And a regular contributor to it is, in fact, Jules Newton, who's our special guest today. Avocado Vision. So you just started it how long ago? Yeah, I think you did say 20 years. That
yeah,
stuck in my mind.
We turned 20 on the 1st of May this year.
All right. Mm. So you've been in the game long, and that is pretty much how old the Democratic South Africa
pretty
is.
Pretty much.
And why did you start it, and why avocado? What's the reason for that? You always get asked that question, I'm sure.
Yes, that's my favorite story. Yeah, you know, I started it with not a very big vision. And the vision itself, I think, has evolved as I've evolved. I was a youngster, starting my own company at 26 and a half years old as a single mom. So at that stage, I think my purpose was a lot to do with helping people, but also, you know, helping people learn the right things, but also the survival. I'm just sitting looking at all of these SME people outside there, and a huge amount of respect for the journey that it takes and to keep a business going for in my mind 20 years. I'm quite proud of myself. I sold it last year too, which was also quite a thing. Avocado Vision.
Another experience.
Yeah, that in itself is a fabulous experience. So Avocado Vision, you know, the story is actually about a piece of property that we bought to put our company on. It's in Kensington, and it looks out over the most magnificent view. And I built a little office and a little boardroom for us to run our training programs in. Mm-hmm. But as I was about to sign off the plans for with the architect, the previous owner, Danny, arrived to fetch his post. And he was devastated when he looked at the plans and realized that I was about to take down the avocado tree that was in the middle of this property. It was the only tree that I was going to take down. There were plenty others. But he was devastated because he had planted that tree. And he said, no, it wasn't any avocado tree. He had eaten the most magnificent avocado he'd ever eaten in his life. And he had been so sad he would never again taste avo like that until he remembered he had that pip. So he went and fished that pip out of the bin and put matchsticks in it and grew the roots and protected it from the frosts of the Joburg winters and so on. And I actually just fell in love with that vision of a lifetime of avocado. When you do the kind of work that we do, which is transformational work, you're always trying to plant trees in whose shade you'll never sit and whose fruit you'll never eat. But you must plant the tree. You must invest in the human beings of the future. So I changed the name of the company. And it kind of changed our soul at that moment too. It made it very clear to us what our purpose was going to be.
So define that purpose then in your own words.
It's helping people make better decisions and live bigger lives. We really are about equipping people with the leadership and capabilities to be able to do the important things that need to be done. And we do that in all sorts of different ways. We work in corporate South Africa and help leaders transform themselves there. We also work in communities across South Africa, setting up micro enterprises who are helping the people in those communities make bigger decisions and live bigger lives. So we really do work in very different places.
So helping people make bigger decisions, better decisions.
Better decisions.
And live bigger lives.
That's it.
Now, we all have that in us, don't we? Mm. And then there's the context of our beautiful South Africa. Just move a little bit this way, Jules,
sure.
So Alice can squeeze in there.
Make some space.
So, and that's in the context of South Africa, which is very transformative. Mm. And it's a tough place too. Mm. It's a microcosm of the world. It's not an easy place to do business in, to lead. It's exciting. It's interesting. It tests you. And it should, by implication, raise great leaders, you know, because of the challenges we face. Probably makes some leaders and it breaks some. Mm. But you've been doing it in 20 years, so you've been in the corporate environment, chipping away, trying to help leaders transform their businesses, their people, take their people along with them. We want to find out more about that journey. Mm. Has the narrative changed? So when you started 20 years ago, which is like middle 90s, 1990s, now we're in 2016. What's still the same and what is very different in terms of this transformation process? It's a broad question, but let's start unpacking that.
What a lovely question. You know, I've been thinking, obviously, as I've been preparing for this conversation and sort of remembering some of our key touch points over the 20 years or so that we've been working in this. And I remember probably about 15 years ago. So we're 5 to 7 years, you know, post-apartheid, and we're in the beginning of our transformation journey. And I was working with one of the senior executives, a very courageous woman who was leading one of the big banks, retail bank. And she had an executive team that she'd been working with, and she called me in and she said, you know, you and your team like doing creative and transformational things. My executives are all driving big, expensive cars, bulletproof, you know, windows and so on. They drive in those cars and park under the building and come up and lead and get back into those cars and head off into the suburbs behind very tall walls. They don't understand the people they lead, and they definitely don't understand the customers that they serve.
Their conversations are about their trip to Italy
and
or this and that, and the
exactly.
skiing trips and so on, while the employees are not.
Can we name that bank?
Yeah, I think we could call any bank, and it would just
pretty much it's standard fare, isn't it?
Yeah.
I know Jack and Maria though drove an old BMW until quite close to the end. It was probably not there. Okay, go.
So she said to us, you know, help us find our own stories, and we put together a program we called the Consource at the time, where we took the guys through a year of conversations where they were meeting human beings who defied stereotyping. And I remember some of the human beings, and it was about conversation, and that for me is such an important part and essence of transformation, is that every human being needs to confront their own and other people's stories and the sort of dignity of being heard and being able to actually say, this is what happened to me, and my personal story has been so important. Oh, we had conversations with Tumi from Tumi and the Volume, and we had conversations with Noria Mabasa, who's an extraordinary artist up in Venda, and with various actors and artists who each one were sort of defining their reality and their context at the time. And every time we had a heart-rending story, we would then, all the exco would go out for dinner with their leader. And then their own stories would become part of the room. And on this exco, we have MK soldiers who are now leading the bank, sitting next to the South African National Defence Force soldiers. We have all sorts of, you know, people whose stories had never been told, people who'd been in jail, people who had been forced to go and fight at 17 years old. And the stories there were about, let's start understanding ourselves for the first time. But you asked me why, how the discourse has changed. And I think the key thing is that we're now 20 years in. Now it's bloody embarrassing if there's stuff you don't know, if there are stories that haven't been told. You no longer want to reveal how untransformed you might be in your own heart. And that, I think, comes from a full spectrum of human beings. And there are so many people who are now intolerant of people's evolution process, whether it be people who were raised in sort of the bastions of apartheid South Africa as white privileged South Africans, or folk who have grown up in townships and are, you know, really meeting corporate South Africa for the first time in their adult employment. Nobody wants to confess to not knowing. And so we've stopped asking each other our stories now.
And that's not good.
And I'm feeling this polarization that's happening, and we're almost kind of cutting into festering wounds all over the place now with the kind of discourses that are happening. And so I don't think that it's new what's happened here. I think it's starting to become raw and exposed. And we must not talk. This is the time to not stop talking. We need to continue our conversations.
Almost like we feel, and say the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Mm. We did some talking there, so it was over
yes.
and done. Bury it. Now, Tick. Next, let's do those conversations. You said 5-7 years into transformation or democracy. Top executives, leaders are isolated. So let's expose them to very unique stories, and it will affect their own stories. And now we're 20 years later, 2016. Do we almost think like we're beyond that, man? We're cool. We're fine, but we're missing the key ingredient of conversations, intense conversations, which is part of a human journey. And we must still do that somehow,
yeah.
you say.
Yeah, you know, the old in the sort of old days, 10 years ago, old days, we were doing diversity workshops all over the place. Everything was about, I'm black, you're white, sorry for the past, let's talk about that and we're done. And even that, I've had many corporate organizations say, we're over that, we're done with that. But of course...
We've grown up.
We've had 20 years, you know, we should all grow up and move on now, for heaven's sake. And really... Really, there is so much working. You know, if you think about a lovely metaphor I heard someone use once, which was, you know, a child who drives their bicycle through a glass window and you know, falls through the window and lacerates themselves and ends up with shards of glass inside them and so on, and goes off to hospital and has all of that cleared up. Years later, those little shards of glass, there are many still under the skin, and every now and then another one works itself to the surface. And when it does, we need to open up that wound and take out that piece of glass. And our entire nation is just walking around with little shards everywhere. And we need to continue the healing and conversation process as we transform ourselves.
Richard.
Jules, I mean, do you think that everybody's at that same point? Because, I mean, my one observation, and I guess I'm fairly young in the process. So, you know, I grew up in the kind of the 94 era was my era when I was in the varsity and spending time in campuses with burning tires and all the good stuff that went with it. And, you know, I think...
What's changed, by the way?
Yeah, I was going to say, not a lot has changed, it would appear. But I mean, the one thing that always amazed me was that, you know, just as there's the stereotypes of, you know, people also stereotype people who are not in the same space. So just because I'm white and... I'm an educated person doesn't necessarily mean that I don't have an understanding and appreciation for what people of color have gone through. In fact, I have a fairly good understanding of that world, and yet people would expect me not to. And I always found that quite interesting when I would interact with people in the corporate world, for example. And I mean, I will never forget a scenario. One of the ladies that worked for me at home. Her father passed away, and so my wife and I and my daughter went off on the weekend off to Naledi in Soweto to go and pay our respects to her mom. And I said, there was two parts of the story that was quite interesting. What was very interesting was on the Monday at work, when I made the comment to some people about where I'd been on the weekend, they looked at me in horror and they're like, "You went into Soweto?" Like, "Yeah, and?" It was like, "You're white. You're not. You're an executive in a corporate. You don't do that stuff." And I didn't think anything of it. It was also quite interesting when I went to see her mom. I happened to walk out of their home at the back of the house, and a neighbor on the other side. Now, most people wouldn't know this because I'm on radio, but I'm a 6'6" white guy and fairly huge. And I walked out of the door, and the neighbor across the wall, the house was slightly higher than these people's home that I was walking out of, and the neighbor opened the door, and this black lady looked at me and screamed. And it was like, I don't know, I must have brought back fears of the pre-apartheid years of these
big policemen
running around. And she slammed the door and then reopened the door later with her husband standing next to her peering out to see who we were. And it was almost like, amazing. You're not allowed to be in our space. Or not so much you're not allowed to, but you are not meant to be here. It's not normal for a white person to pay respects to...
No, it's a white big person.
Yeah, a big white guy to pay respects in a black cultural space.
Okay.
And that was a very interesting experience for me because I kind of went, sure, we're very quick.
What year are you in there, approximately?
That must have been in about... probably about 2011.
No way, that's the other day.
Yeah, you know, I think the question you asked at the beginning, Richard, I think is such an important one that we all need to be, you know, connecting with. And that is that, you know, how do we feel about people at a different stage of transformation from ourselves? And I think that for me is the absolute key. This thing is so complex. The minute we try and put it in a bucket and give it headings and sort of take a whole lot of people on a journey with an assumption of where they are now and where they need to go, you're kind of lost. Every single human being transforms or does not transform at their own pace, based on their own experiences and their own pieces of exposure. One of the key places, though, of transformation, I think, is at work. You know, so often folk gather in their social places with people that are similar. But the minute you're at work, you are now engaging with human beings who are the same or very different from you. And I think that's why a lot of the transformational work is born in those places, because we really, you know, we know that all sorts of research has shown how much value diversity can bring to to the efficiency of organizations, and organizations who learn how to incorporate the diversity of the people that work for them and the customers that they serve, they succeed very powerfully. But of course, how you do that and how you work with people's stereotypes and journeys and so on is a challenge. And you know, in South Africa, we've now got this tool called the BE Codes of Best Practice, which some people embrace wholeheartedly, and other people think, you know, the devil incarnate, because how dare you force me to give away a part of our company and so on. And I think that those tools drive conversations and behaviors actually quite powerfully. I must say, I'm, you know, disclosure, I think I am a quite a key proponent actually of Black economic empowerment and the BEE codes of best practices tools. I mean, it has its issues, of course it does. Everything that you try and do does. But at least it starts giving us some sort of sense as an organization about how transformed are we, and where are the behaviors we need to be putting in place to effect the shifts that we need in the companies that we serve, which then have a huge impact on the economy of the country itself.
Have we taken that home though? Mm. So you're saying the work environment is probably the place where obviously we're exposed to a lot of diversity. People almost bring their home in there. But then they go home and different conversations happen there. Different friendship circles around the braai or around the whatever, you know, dinner table. I don't know whether... So it's almost we had a professional hat on at work. Professionally, I have to transform. Then I go back home and I drop my mask. And now we tell the racist jokes around the fire.
Yeah, and for me, that's quite a different conversation. You know, and maybe there are folk who are not going home and telling racist jokes around the fire, but still gather with people that are like themselves because there's comfort there.
Yeah.
You know, you go, yeah.
You and I had a conversation beforehand. I really would like Arden,
yes,
to touch upon the model that she proposes to bring about that kind of change. We've had a previous discussion of direction. I think it's very important that people think they're applying transformation, but they're not. You have to go through those phases of behavioral change.
Yeah, I'll talk about it a little bit, Louis. You know, it's a model of how you shift these kinds of things, and we apply it in many places, but one of them is transformation. I don't actually even have a name for it, but I'm so interested often is when I'm invited to engage and support corporate organizations on some sort of change and transformational journey, is that because part of some of the things that our company does is training, folk think that if I train people differently, I'm going to get different results. That's actually what it is, you know. So we want this behavior and we want these results, so will you please come in and train this new way of behaving? This is how we're going to do it. And unfortunately, I mean, if you think about, you know, the biggest issue in our country, which we faced for and fought for many years, has been just HIV education. And we all understand that, you know, wearing condoms protects people from HIV infection, and yet there are so many people who don't do it, even though they have the knowledge. But so it can't simply be about educating somebody about knowledge. We actually need to step further back in the way that we intervene with human beings.
Drinking and driving kills you, and speed kills you. We know all those things, but we still speed.
We still make terrible decisions because we haven't really kind of taken that shift in behavior under our skin. And you know, I just was talking, in fact, just recently to one of the big corporate organizations in our country who are kind of starting to feel that we are too slow on transformation. And we are in so many places. And we're not reaching even the code of best practice requirements. So even from a compliance perspective, we're not there. And if we have a look around the room, we don't necessarily have the right sort of mix of talent in our room yet and so on. And guys are challenged by managers, thousands of managers throughout this business, not making good transformational behaviors. And I think you actually first need to begin and intervene where people think. Because the way I think about something actually influences how I feel about it. And the way I feel about something impacts my behavior, which then impacts the results that I have. And so we actually have to begin in the place where we are addressing these fundamental thoughts and feelings that come, the filters that we approach life with. And all we need sometimes is something that exposes ourselves to those filters. So if you are wanting to transform an organization and the human beings in that organization, because that's where it begins, and the management decisions that are made all the way through that decision, you've actually got to say to yourself, not necessarily just what results that I want, which is a transformed business, but what do I need the people in my organization to think about the transformation? And I've just made some notes for myself here, but some of it is things like just the transformation is essential for our economy. if I believe in our country, I actually need to be making transformational decisions every single day in order to effect the transformation that the economy needs. Or diversity makes us stronger. Just that is a belief that I've got to actually help the guys in the organization understand. I've got to expose you to insights and research and so on that helps you see how much stronger and more competitive we can be as an organization for that. Or if we do this well, we can be influencing the outcome of and the performance of our economy, because our business is of such a size that actually a change inside this business means a change and transformation for our country.
Jules, can I be a devil's advocate?
Yeah, go.
Adrian, I don't know how you're managing the show. I'm keeping more quiet than I should.
No, go.
Look, I think when we had a conversation around transformation with Stella the other day, I mentioned the fact that perhaps one of our biggest problems is that we talk about transformation, but our push for transformation is such that there's no stick aspect to it, you know. So therefore, you know, it's good for the economy, but would people really see that as something that they therefore need to provide a buy-in to without any form of punishment if they were not to follow through with that buy-in? Is that something that you think perhaps is deficient with the process, that there's no censure? I mean, we just have to beg and plead and be nice, but is that really what's going to drive transformation at the end of the day when there's no economic pinch to be felt around these issues?
So Jules, just before you go in there, earlier we were saying some people become small entrepreneurs because of discomfort. In fact, you said it, Alice. Mm-hmm. So discomfort drives me to do something new, to move forward. And that's kind of also the area you're talking about, I think. You maybe start a new business with a vision and a purpose and so on, but you're also trying to get away from some sort of discomfort. And now we come to change. Mm-hmm. Maybe all of us change partly with a big picture and to change thoughts and how you think about certain things. But where's the discomfort?
Mm. Yeah, and I think that, I mean, there is to some level for organizations some sort of economic penalty, simply because if you don't have good BEE scorecards, you struggle to, you know, the beginning of the food chain starts with government tenders. So, you know,
Certainly. So
I know that in years before, when I didn't understand the scorecard at all and didn't really understand how it applied to me as a white woman owning a really small business, I started getting really irritated with the big banks, for example, trying to force this on me, because I was so, you know, what difference could I possibly make at my kind of scale? But because they will not land the government tenders, they've got to make sure that they're procuring from transformed organizations. What I found out afterwards was that the behavior that my little company exhibits, which is at that stage a white-owned, 100% woman-owned business, we were so transformational in our activities that we were actually achieving so much. We went from nothing to a level 1 BEE score simply because we were already doing the stuff. So we had a wholehearted commitment to transformation. We just weren't inside the scorecard space. Mm-hmm. But I think what the scorecard helps us achieve is the sort of punitive exclusion from lucrative opportunities if you're not transforming well. So for me, there's a bit of it. I would love it to go to the point where it's legislation, and now I'm going to irritate half of your audience because, you know, everybody gets very upset when people say those things. But I do agree that there are a whole lot of organizations who are freaking stubborn about this stuff. And if we're not going to force them to do it, they're not going to.
It's like compliance is an option. I mean, you mentioned this, Adrian, that, you know, when you drop on these codes, you know, your score goes down. What is it that will push you to want to go back up?
Yeah. Well, I also have the question of, you know, some organizations perhaps aren't that reliant on, you know, the government tenders, the likes. But, you know, the reality is, and, you know, maybe this is where the fees must fall hashtag comes to mind here, is there's also a little bit of a social conscience that we as a country need to start. You know, the reality is if an entity is not compliant, or they choose to be non-compliant, who's holding them accountable? Is the press holding them accountable? You know, is there, let's call it the shareholder activism type of movements where people are, and that now moves into the social space to say, well, company X actually has chosen to go non-compliant, in terms of the new codes, or they are non-compliant in terms of the new codes. Therefore, we're going to ask their CEO some tough questions about why they believe that it's not important to be part of the new South African environment. And those conversations haven't started yet, but I foresee that those are going to start up quite quickly. And yeah, I've seen a number of organizations where perhaps that isn't on their agenda or even on their radar, and I think they may be fooling themselves in thinking that they're not going to have to deal with, let's call it, social media pressure and journalistic pressure and people asking these questions of saying, so maybe you don't have to tick the scorecard for government tenders, but we as the people are holding you accountable.
Yeah.
And that is going to happen.
Agreed.
I have no doubt
agreed,
about that.
Richard.
We must understand, though, that we obviously need a bigger stick, but let's not fool ourselves. You'll still need those processes to bring about transformation. Mm. The bigger stick helps, but ultimately the skills in bringing about those processes of changing has got to be done, and the sooner we practice that, the better.
Mm. But what's the time frame that we're working on here? I mean, to be realistic, someone listening on this program, you know, 18-year-old, you know, is out of matric, you know, will soon be looking for a job or something. What is it? At what point do you say, yes, we've transformed? I mean, or is this one continuous generational thing we're talking about? We'll be replaced, just as you sit here, by another crew that will talk the same language 20, 30 and beyond.
Jules.
I do think that it's a long process, Ellis. I'd love to say that there was a quick fix button that we can just press and this thing works. But, you know, if I just think about... If you think about privilege, what we're sitting with, and I heard some of your earlier folk talking about how poverty is just one of those very, very sort of deep drivers of so much of this stuff. And in South Africa, of course, the biggest poverty-stricken population is a black population. And when I look at my son, I put my kids into government schools. But I come from an educated household. I had the best education that white apartheid South Africa had to offer. I had every single privilege that was handed to me on a plate. And my children now, when they sit at my dinner table, we are having conversations about, you know, business issues. And, you know, my children just every single day are moving into a headspace that's going to set them up for success. And my children are at school in government schools with kids who live in squatter camps. Mm-hmm. And when those kids sit together, even in classrooms, those kids in the squatter camps do not have parents where those kinds of conversations are taking place. And of course, once they've moved through school, and they've, even the most determined of them who get wonderful CSI bursaries and so on, and get the education that they would never have been able to afford for themselves, and they break their own personal cycle of poverty, the moment they walk into a corporate organization, they are at a disadvantage. If you think of it as a race, if they are not starting in the same starting line as my children, they are 100 meters behind. And then everyone says, you're a child who was born post-apartheid. You should be able to compete. But those kids have got other stuff. They've got families and, you know, in poverty-stricken places. They are supporting children. They're the first wage earner in the family. And that kind of thing doesn't transform fast. And until we understand that that's what we're dealing with and acknowledge that that's what we're dealing with, we are going to go slowly.
Okay, we have to wrap it up. But like every conversation, we realize we need more. Mm. And here's the thing also, Alice. We can't see this as an event. And in fact, right now it's got different flavors, the whole transformation journey. 5 or 10 years from now, it'll have other flavors. Ours is very sensitive, and it's got race mingled with economics, as we discovered
That's
earlier.
That's the story of South Africa.
That's the story of South Africa. But we have to adopt a conversational... transformation attitude as leaders, and we had that in the first half hour of our 3-hour block. What kind of leader should you be in today's world to be able to do this? So it's just words mess it up for us a bit, because we use different words and then our minds jump into different spaces. But it's got to be a mindset. It's got to be a way you lead. This is not now I'm doing transformation in my business, now I'm doing the business, now I'm talking transformation again, and then now I have to talk numbers. This is just the way you lead has to be transformational.
Exactly.
And it's got to be deep conversations. We've got to hear each other's stories. I was in Dubai once with a Shell team, and I couldn't believe on that team how every person was from another country. Mm. And I thought, my goodness, this guy's leading someone who's from Africa, someone who's from England, someone who's from America, And then I go back to South Africa and it's diversity. Mm. It's totally different. Anyway,
I totally agree with you, Adrian, on the leadership aspect. But at the same time, I fail to understand why leaders, CEOs, executives would not see, you know, the imperative for transformation as a great opportunity for them to build legacies and effect positive change, you know, to which, you know, generations would look back and say, wow, there was a leader who brought something positive.
I think some believe they do, but they don't really necessarily. Mm. Final word, Jules, we've got over time, but two leaders out there.
I loved the word that Ellis just used, which is about legacy. And I think every one of us who cares about the future of our country needs to continually challenge ourselves about the transformational legacy that we're leading.
Mm. Jules Newton, CEO, Avocado Vision. Thank you. I'm sure we'll sit down with you again. Richard Angus, thank you so much. And Ellis Nyandu.
You're welcome.
Louis and I are staying on. It's the leadership and education part of the show. So stay with us.
Cliff Central. I've got something important to tell you.
CliffCentral.com.